You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 30th of October to the 5th of November 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by Deputy News Editor John Morgan, Junior Reporter John Elms and Reporter Chris Havergal. Warwick Professor Thomas Doherty has been cleared of any wrongdoing after a tribunal. The case saw him accused of undermining the authority of a former head of department, but it may still leave him with a £50,000 bill. John Morgan has more on that in a second. The Immigration Minister, James Brokenshire, has been criticised as complacent and silly. Find out why in a couple of moments' time. Chris Havergal has been clocking up the miles. He reported from Scotland last week. He's reporting from the Reinventing HE conference, which took place in Madrid last week, in this week's podcast. More on that in a second. And since this is technically our Halloween issue, we should look at our spooky feature this week, which looks at things that go bump in the night in some of our ancient seats of learning. But first, John. Thomas Doherty, it's a case we've followed closely for a good while, and it seems to be coming to something of a conclusion.
That's right. So it emerged last week that Professor Doherty, who had been suspended since January, has now been cleared of all charges after being investigated by a university tribunal. Professor Doherty, who's a very prominent critic of the marketisation of higher education, had, as you say, been charged by Warwick with undermining the authority of Catherine Bates, the former head of the English department. And our former colleague David Matthews had done some very good digging, and earlier this year David uncovered that the case against Professor Doherty cited three incidents in which he was alleged to have undermined Professor Bates, including sighing, projecting negative body language and making ironic comments when interviewing candidates for a job at Warwick. So despite having been cleared of the charges, it's still unclear as to who is going to pay Professor Doherty's legal bill, which I understand is likely to approach £50,000. It appears that Warwick told him at an earlier stage in the process that it would not pay his bills, but I gather there's now some kind of negotiation going on as to who will cover the costs. And Warwick's also refused to answer questions on the size of its own legal bill, which one would imagine would be the equal, if not exceeding, of Professor Doherty's bill. And you've also got the fact that the tribunal had its own barrister, which will further add to the costs.
Yeah, best to leave some of those details there until we do know more. You had another story I noticed that we ran online. Professor Doherty, very touched by some of the support that he'd had from people in the sector during this ordeal.
Yes, that's right. He wrote on a Facebook group that had been set up in his support how much he'd appreciated the words on there and sort of backing him throughout this process, which has been going on since he was suspended in January. And it was interesting to see that it's now also been reported in the national papers, and it was really widely reported by papers like the Telegraph and also in the regional press in the West Midlands. So it does seem to have been a case that's sort of broken through to the national media after it was reported in those salient details about the nature of the charges against him were reported earlier this year by THE.
Indeed, yeah. Moving on, one of your other pieces this week regards the Immigration Minister, James Brokenshire. He's been talking about why government policy isn't necessarily behind falls in the number of students heading to the UK from India, and not everyone took those comments well.
No, James Brokenshire, one of the most popular figures in English higher education, along with Theresa May.
It's, the big one too.
Some big fans of theirs around universities. So James Brokenshire made a speech at a conference hosted by Home Affairs Select Committee in Regent's University London last week. It was a conference on student visas, and we haven't had the chance to hear from the Immigration Minister for a while. And he said a couple of things that universities would find rather provocative. He talked about the fall in the number of Indian students coming to the UK, which has halved extremely dramatically from 24,000 to 12,000 in the 2 years to 2012-13. Obviously, that's a really key market for British universities. And he basically said that that fallen Indian students couldn't be down to government immigration policy, because the number of Indian student, the number of Chinese students, sorry, has gone up in the same period. So can't be our fault.
Of course, all policies affect all countries equally.
And one figure in the sector pointed out that there is quite a big difference between the Chinese and Indian markets, and that the closure of the post-study work route in 2012 is thought to have had a really big impact, in particular on Indian students, because you know they're taking out loans to fund their studies and they want to start paying them back straight away by getting work straight away. And Bill Rammell, Vice Chancellor of the University of Bedfordshire, went even further, and he was expected to say in a speech at Parliament this week that he was concerned at the complacency of the minister's response. Mm. And another thing that Mr. Brokenshire said was that the fall in the number in the overall number of non-EU students coming to the UK also not down to government immigration policy, because if you look at 2012-13, the number of home and EU students fell even more than the number of non-EU students. So it must be part of a wider trend facing our universities. But obviously in 2012-13, something quite big happened that would affect domestic student numbers, namely £9,000 fees. So probably not the best year to measure things against, really.
Indeed. Well, that story in full is on page 9 this week. The Thomas Doherty story is on page 7. On page 10, the headline reads, "Europe needs to come together right now over higher education conference told." Now, that was the Reinventing HE conference in Madrid, Chris, that you were at.
That's right. And it's not very fashionable at the moment to be saying that we need more Europe. Less Europe is very much the trend. But this is the comments from the Secretary-General of the League of European Research Universities, saying that in terms of competition with places like the US, China and the emerging BRICS nations, that the EU, I mean, he went as far to say that Europe was not going to survive in terms of a sort of world-class higher education system if it continues with 28 different sets of research systems, funding systems, tuition fee systems, and suggested that actually the European Union should go as far as legislating to harmonise the systems of higher education across the continent.
The United Universities of Europe.
Yeah, it's not very fashionable, but it does perhaps show the seriousness with which organisations such as the League of European Research Universities views that competition and is concerned about how Europe is performing. Clearly this follows on from the Bologna process, and that what that tried to do was to standardise qualifications across Europe so they could be more interchangeable and recognised across borders. And it's a suggestion that this now, in terms of research and funding, in terms of going much further, is the next step.
It's very difficult, though, isn't it? I mean, even within countries, to recognise credit at one institution as being of equal or more or less value than credit at another institution is hard enough, isn't it, without bringing in different nations.
And that's true. One of the things with the Bologna process is that it has introduced these sort of standards of how degrees should be interchangeable across borders, but actually in practice the implementation of that by countries has varied, so I'm not sure whether you're going to see Brussels taking this issue on in the very near future.
No. One of the pieces you had there just at the bottom, which I think we covered online as well, was a suggestion by Charles Hardy, who's the Education Engagement Lead at LinkedIn, the business social network, suggesting that employers could help to fill some of the funding gap in European HE by contributing to the cost of tuition faced by their graduate recruits. So is this employers handing over money to the universities that educated their staff?
Well, it's an interesting idea, Charles Hardy's case. I mean, I should say this came in the context of a wider discussion about, you know, how do you fill that funding gap? That, you know, clearly there's a lot of pressure on public finances across Europe, and there's concern about what the impact would be of increasing the burden further on students. Mm. It's a very varied picture across Europe. But Charles Hardy's case was that if employers are benefiting from the qualifications that their graduates have, they should make a contribution. And he also went as suggested that if employers were financially invested in these qualifications that students were gaining, they'd be more likely to engage with universities and work with universities to ensure the graduates are of the high standard. It's an interesting idea, and you'd think someone at LinkedIn would be keeping their ear to the ground in terms of what might be good for the business community.
Absolutely. Well, page 10 for those two stories this week. Our lead news story this week warns that universities could face a winter of discontent of escalating industrial action if academics are docked pay for participating in marking boycotts that are due to start next week at pre-92 institutions. Check that out. That's by Jack Grove. He's not with us, but you can read the whole story in our magazine and, of course, at timeshighereducation.co.uk. Also in the news, a workable and affordable model for state-backed postgraduate loans could soon be on the cards, and also privately educated students go on to earn more than their state educated peers. Find out by how much by reading this week's news section. And before we move on to you, John, our cover feature this week is by Andrew McGettigan. It looks at the issues surrounding the millions of pounds of public money going to students studying at private institutions. But the second feature is an altogether more terrifying proposition. It concerns hauntings at some of the UK's university. John Elms, you read it, and I believe it's written by a former tutor of yours, Richard Sugg, English lecturer at Durham University.
Yeah, that wasn't the reason I read it, although it is always nice to see your former tutors in the magazine that you work for. Dr. Sugg taught me Shakespeare in third year at university, and you should be gratified to say I'm going to pass that module with flying colours. This is actually last year. Dr. Sugg wrote a piece for us about vampires on Halloween. So it's almost like the second in the series. I'm not sure it is a series, but this one is about ghosts at our ancient seats of learning, as you say, Chris, and in the older institutions, the universities that have been around for so long that they probably have had enough deaths involved in their time to have ghosts.
Clock of a spirit or two.
Exactly. But the I think the point of the piece is that, obviously, ghosts and sightings of the paranormal are very popular around the world. But if you see one at a university and you're an academic or part of an higher education institution, to then suggest that you'd seen one to your peers might be difficult
frowned upon.
But there is an academic slant to it, as Dr. Sugg points out, in that it's not particularly about a place that ghosts are seen. It's about an individual person, and he writes the possibility of people seeing ghosts. This leads to a related possibility, namely that certain people sense or see ghosts because there is something unusual about their brain, or because something unusual, such as infrasound or an electromagnetic field, is affecting their brain at the moment. So there is a a neurological side to it. That stems into the fact that it could be, associated hauntings are pure hallucinations. But he then does write, in some cases, it indicates that an unusual brain state allows perception of something real which others cannot sense or see. So that would, in some ways, explain why someone did see a ghost and why other people haven't. It comes down to whether you believe or not. But he does give a load of examples from Oxford, Cambridge, of these various ghostly sightings. Some, of course, are hoaxes. Others are less easy to explain.
From the feature, it seems like only Oxbridge has ghosts.
It does
not
seem
content
to
with
that.
Hogging all the prestige. The ancient universities have ghosts, so they're no post 1992.
I did look through the piece. They haven't
from this piece.
Not yet.
Well,
potentially someone who unfortunately dies at a post 1992 might then decide to haunt their institution. He does actually. In the piece, our reporters give a nice example of other universities where this occurs. Again, not post 92s, although the University of South Wales is mentioned in its previous guise, the University of Wales Newport. At Durham, my institution and Dr. Sugg's, I didn't know this story actually. It's seems to be only associated with University College, where the Durham, which is situated in Durham Castle. Yeah. Frederick Coatman, who studied at the institution in the early 19th century, one of the first students. He lived in the highest room in Durham Castle, and so it goes when he He went to check his exam results when they're pinned up on the board. He couldn't see his name. And when he couldn't find his name, he thought he had failed his exam. So he went up to the top of the cathedral tower and threw himself off. Mm. It later transpired that he couldn't see his name because it was obscured at the top of the list of first class graduates by a sheet directly above it. So it just proves that you shouldn't get too worked up about exam results.
And you should get your eyes tested before you go and find out your results. Loads of those examples in that feature, which is on page 40 this week. That's all for this week's issue review. If you've got anything you wish to say about the items we've discussed, or indeed anything in the magazine this week, you'll find us at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter at timeshighered, on Facebook, on Google+, LinkedIn as well, all the usual places. So do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.